Welcome to the Growing EBITDA podcast, where we unlock the doors to management and technology insights in the middle market. Join us as we explore innovative strategies to drive revenue and EBITDA growth, interviewing industry leaders and technology experts. Whether you're looking to streamline operations, understand the latest tech trends, or lead your company towards exponential growth, you're in the right place. Stay tuned and let's grow together.
Well, we're off to quite a start this year, aren't we?
Man.
A lot going on in the world, isn't there?
Every day there's a new news flash, I feel.
I think so. So how many people's budgets do you think are going to be spot on this year with all the tariffs changing cost of goods sold around?
Yeah, I think plus or minus 30 to, depending on temperaments, 40%.
There you go. Maybe. That'd be a good guess. I think guessing is just pretty much what everybody's doing these days, trying to figure it out. So for our listeners who haven't guessed it yet, today we're talking about tariffs, something near and dear to everybody's heart in 2025 with the current political climate, shall we say. You know, I think this is going to impact almost every business in some way, shape, or form. I mean, you're going to be hard-pressed. Maybe some B2B, B2C services businesses aren't going to be impacted that much, but certainly anybody with a widget in their value chain to some degree or another are going to be impacted pretty heavily by widgets, not just on the operating company side, but obviously it's going to impact the private equity community a lot too. The impact it's going to have on people's P&Ls is going to make a lot of folks rethink valuations, deal structures, potentially exit timing. Just a lot going on given the global supply chains that we have and how prolific some of these tariff programs are going to be.
Yeah. And, you know, Mike, to that point, one of our main verticals is manufacturers, right? So we deal with a lot of manufacturing folks. And so I always love to get the Wall Street Journal update on where that's at. And I'm not sure if you saw that poll that went out, but I think it's like 80% of businesses think they'll be affected by tariffs, which to me is interesting that 80% of businesses. Fun fact, we found out that one of the businesses, actually, Mike, would you like to guess what type of business that the poll said that would not be affected by tariffs as much as others?
No idea.
Business services. And I thought,
oh, there you go.
Wow,
got it right. I thought it was a trick question.
Yeah. Business services is an interesting one. I was like, wow, that's an interesting, because it's very insular. We saw a lot of deal movement last year. So if I'm a betting man, I'm assuming we're going to see some more deal movement this year on that one. Because again, if you're not selling something, you just kind of have humans doing work, it might be a little protected from the tariffs. But to your point, most folks are going to be affected.
Yeah.
And to the poll, 80%.
Yeah.
So I think one of the things that to that point, and as we start to kind of break that down and go through the conversation today, Mike, I think this one squarely fits in your side of the world. And so if you don't mind, I'll take point on asking you some of the questions that I kind of teed up here to walk through.
Shoot.
Does that work for you?
Shoot. Yep.
You know, you said PE and you said others, and I agree with that, right? Like we hoped for this year to be a good M&A year. And we discussed that in a couple podcasts, whether that's be strategics trying to snap up businesses because we think there's better deal multiples out there, whether that's PE needing to deploy dry powder. We've talked about a few vectors of why we think it's going to be a good M&A year. And I have this feeling, and I'm happy to be proven wrong, that tariffs are going to create a bit of uncertainty this year in that deal making. So we think that there's going to be a lot of movement, but these tariffs may cause a bit of doubt in the market. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think I would only change one word, which is you use the word bit, a bit of doubt. I think it's creating a lot of doubt. I think that you're right. We did expect 25 to be a very active year for M&A. And we're sitting here a couple of months in and it hasn't really been the case. I mean, there's been some decent activity, but nowhere near as busy as I think a lot of folks were thinking it would be. And a lot of it has to do with the change in foreign policy and these tariffs and the change in the administration. I think there are a lot of folks that thought Trump would be a boon for M&A activity. And I don't think that anybody would say that they expected this level of tariff. And I think that's going to, you know, that's caused a lot of people to kind of pause, rethink their strategies. Tariffs, to an outsider, you may think like, hey, yeah, it's a tax that's being levied. It wasn't there before. From an M&A perspective, though, you know, investors like stability, right? So when you deal, let's just go back to your example, a manufacturing business where you have 50% cost of goods sold, right? It's 50% of the cost of your product is in the materials that you use to make it. If those materials are coming in from Canada, Mexico, China, your cost may just have gone up 20 or 30% overnight, right? And most businesses' profit margins aren't even 20 to 30%. So now you're confronted with a couple of things. You've spent the last couple of years, hopefully, passing on some inflation-driven price increases. Can your customers tolerate yet more 20%, 30% higher price increases to offset the tariffs? Likely not. It's got to come from somewhere, right? You're going to try to negotiate some price concessions from your suppliers. You're going to try and squeeze out costs out of your supply chain. But, you know, even the best businesses in the world, best management teams in the world, they'd be lucky to save 2, 3, 4%. You're not going to squeeze 20, 30% out, right? So this is, these tariffs are going to create significant cost volatility, very difficult for management teams to manage through, to budget for. And likewise for investors, just very difficult to estimate like what's going to happen, right? You and I are sitting here today and some of the tariffs have been announced but not implemented. Others, you know, have already been implemented. They could go up higher. Who knows what Trump's going to do? And investors just don't like uncertainty. And I think one of the reasons you touched on, James, last year, very busy year for business services. I think some people saw these tariffs as a potential risk and said, hey, I'm going to go and invest in, you know, industries that hopefully will be less impacted by it. It's unavoidable for folks that buy manufacturing, distribution companies, a lot of this stuff coming from overseas. We're going to have to live through it. So as a result, you know, it's going to create a lot of uncertainty in deals, uncertainty in valuations, and it is going to impact M&A. I think we're already starting to see it impact M&A. Second thing too is just general supply chain disruptions. A lot of businesses have only just now found their steady footing coming out of COVID with all the inventory challenges, price increases, demand imbalances that came along with that. I think this is just going to be yet one more year. The 2020s, they're probably going to have a name for this decade. And it's probably going to have something to do with supply chain. It'll be the first time ever, but maybe to do with supply chain and tariffs, because that's kind of defining the decade for many of these kinds of businesses. And also, I just think regulatory instability. People don't know where trade policy is heading. You know, it was fairly stable for many years. It's been changing quite rapidly more recently. I think people are just going to be a little bit more uncertain in terms of what lies ahead. And all these things, package them up, put a bow on them, just driving a lot of uncertainty for deal makers.
Yeah, Mike. And so with that uncertainty that we feel on that side, and obviously the deal maker side is feeling some of that pressure. Before we move on to a couple other topics I'm sure you have, just a quick question about the other side of it, right? So a lot of times our listeners are folks who own a business that maybe hasn't been transacted, hasn't gone through M&A, and they kind of use us, again, to use our title, to help grow that EBITDA, yep. Right? And so if I'm a business, just because going back on that disruption side, right? And I know that my current business relies a lot on international trade and the countries that you mentioned, Canada, Mexico, China, that we know are going to be affected by tariffs here shortly. What do I think about? I want to transact this year. I know I want to sell my business this year, but I know a lot of my cogs are going to get tied up in this tariff side. What are some of those things that our kind of listeners should be thinking about of like, okay, I need to understand and how to articulate, to your point, that cost volatility and those disruptions. What are some ways that they should start to capture that, at least in their management team, before going out to the market?
I think having a handle on what you think is going to happen, right? Making sure that all of your imports are coded appropriately. You know, they have digital solutions. I'm not an expert here, but they have digital solutions that can help you navigate that. You know, there's obviously consultants that you can engage to help make sure that you've coded things historically appropriately and you kind of know how to navigate that on a go-forward basis. I think if you were on pace to kind of exit a business this year, it's certainly something that you're going to talk about. I wouldn't say that it's going to dissuade, or I wouldn't say that it should dissuade you from pursuing M&A. I think you just need to have in the forefront of your mind that this is going to be a topic that people want to dig in. And to a degree, it's going to be in part outside your control. You know, could you wait? Yes. But other things could happen if you wait. You know, who knows when another pandemic's around the corner or a war's around the corner or some other, you know, black swan event that could have an even more material impact on the business. I think that if I owned a business and I was thinking about selling it this year, it's certainly going to be something I think about, but it's not going to cause me to lose too much sleep over it. Now, I'm sure there's a couple of examples out there that folks will think up, businesses that are a little bit more commodity in nature. If you were importing raw aluminum from China last year, this year is going to look a lot different. If 10% of your supply chain comes from China and it's commodities that are, you know, maybe sub-assemblies or something like that, where maybe there's content coming in from other countries, or, you know, you're doing the vast majority of the value add here in the U.S., I think you might think about it a little bit differently.
Oh, that's really helpful. I think you mentioned something that we talked about before getting on this cast that we maybe didn't talk about at the top of it, is it's important for our listeners to know that we're also not lawyers, we're not experts in tariffs, we're not tax folks. This is kind of two business folks that are discussing what tariffs effects we think they're going to be in the marketplace, and mm-hmm. not from a place of studied. And by the way, anybody who knows what's going on right now and has a crystal ball would be making millions, because we're all trying to figure it out. So
absolutely.
Our crystal ball broke down before the podcast today. Anything else on that uncertainty that you wanted to discuss? Because I have another topic if you're...
Go for it.
All right, great. So this goes back to a little bit what we were talking about, because I wanted to tee up the last question because I think it sets a nice baseline for this one, is how investors are adjusting their valuation models. I put that in my notes because my thought was like, okay, so we don't know what the certainty is. We're not really sure what's going on. But now I'm thinking about afterwards is like, if I'm someone at at a principal level that's sitting in a, let's call it a PE firm, because that's easy, and I'm working up the deal valuation, and we talked about it from the uncertainty of the, I'm going to transact my business. You gave us a nice explanation there. But now I'm on the other side. I want to buy this business. Again, a strategic, a PE firm, who cares? And I'm thinking about how that calculation happens. What am I, like, am I adjusting for that? How am I predicting to adjust for that? What sources could I use? Just kind of give me what you would be doing if you were on the other side of the table.
Yeah, well, I won't just tell you what I'm doing. I'll tell you what I'm kind of seeing other people do too. I mentioned investors don't like uncertainty, right? And we're in a period right now of fairly reasonable uncertainty, right? What we know is that our costs are going to be quite volatile in the months ahead. We don't know exactly how volatile they're going to be, right? So we're going to have to make some educated estimates and hopefully create some downside protection for us. What I'm seeing, lighter M&A, and M&A works like most other marketplaces in the world. It's a function of supply and demand, right? So you're going to see costs for assets, as investors refer to them, or prices for businesses, maybe as an owner of a business would kind of think about it, probably come down a tad, but it's not meaningful. Like, we're not seeing a 5 or 10 or 20% decline in the value of these businesses, at least not yet. There's still a lot of capital out there looking for homes, looking for businesses to buy. So I think some of the risk premium, it may show up 5-ish percent. I think what you're going to see, though, what's really starting to change is the amount of focus on diligence of tariff impact, right? So you should expect these investors to come in and really do a deep dive and hire some outside experts, lawyers, tax attorneys, things like that, to really dive into the impact of tariffs. Probably want to understand the opportunity to resource or reshore some of the component parts or commodities that the business is buying, and doing some financial analysis around that. I think probably the thing I'm seeing the most right now is what I would describe as creative deal structuring. So instead of reducing the price for a business, I think you're going to see more investors, especially right now, as the tariff uncertainty is probably at its peak, they're going to go to a seller of a business and say, hey, listen, I know you want $500 million for your business, but we did some math and we think that tariffs could have like a $40 million impact on your enterprise value, right? The price that we're going to pay for the company. So instead of paying you $500 million for the business, which by the way, we think it's worth $500 million, it's just too risky for us to price in no tariff risk today. I'll still pay you $500 million, but we're going to put $40 million in escrow, and then subject to these outcomes from a tariff perspective occurring, either we get that $40 million back, or you get to keep as the seller that $40 million or some split in between. We're not going to get into the mechanics of how those specifically come together, but we call these holdbacks in private equity, right? So the money goes into an account on its way to the seller, and provided that the investors don't get stung with some huge tariff exposure in this case, that would be released to the seller of the business. If they do get stung, some portion of it, potentially all of it, could come back to the investors. And that effectively is a purchase price reduction for the asset. But it's a nice way of bringing a buyer and a seller to the table and saying, hey, listen, we probably aren't going to be able to agree on a specific number today, given the volatility. Let's agree on what the business is worth. Generally speaking, we're going to give you the vast majority of that value up front, but we're going to hold some portion of that back to account for uncertainty and risk that we just fundamentally can't price into our models today.
Wow, I didn't even know that was a thing. That's a very interesting. Have we seen that before in other ways, Mike, that weren't tariffs that happen in deals? Is this a common thing?
Yeah, I think, you know, we saw it with the last round of tariffs a number of years ago. Sometimes you'll see it in the wake of very seismic shifts in the global markets. You know, when COVID happened, you'd see a lot of businesses whose earnings had completely tanked, right? Their revenue was way down. If they were a retail business, their store visits were down. If they were an airline, their passenger miles flown were down. You know, most businesses had just a huge impact when the economy shut down, but it didn't completely shut down M&A, right? Like 6 months later, investors, like private equity investors, were coming in and saying, hey, listen, in 2019, your business made, let's say, $10 million in profit. In 2020, it made $1 million in profit, but it looks like it's going to get back in 2021 to making about $10 or $11 million in profit. So we're going to kind of run rate out your current profit. We're going to assume that it's going to get back to that same level of profitability, maybe on slightly higher sales as things rebound in the case of COVID, as the entire economy rebounded. And if it does, we would value your business at this. The fact that it hasn't rebounded yet, that's a problem for us as investors. So maybe instead of paying you 100% of the value for the business, let's just say it was $100 million in that case, instead of paying you $100 million today, because it only makes from a last 12 months perspective, it's only made $1 million in profit, we'd be paying you 100 times trailing 12 months earnings. Instead of doing that, because that really wouldn't be fair, right? They're saying, hey, listen, I'm going to kind of give you some consideration that this business is likely to bounce back. Maybe I'm going to give you $50 million today. We're going to put another $50 million in escrow, and provided that revenue comes back, the earnings come back with it, we'll release that to you as the seller. And quite frankly, it's a nice way of continuing to allow a marketplace for deals to happen, right? It gives the owners liquidity. It gives the buyers a buying opportunity, which otherwise would be shut down, right? And then nobody does anything, right? And the last thing that any of us want is every dollar in the capital market sitting on the sidelines waiting, right? You want these kind of transactions to occur. And that's just one of the many creative ways that the finance community has come up with to address those valuation gaps, particularly in times of uncertainty.
That's really, really neat. And I love these learnings, because I think this is one of those times that we learn a lot, see a lot, right? And so, like, one of the things I'm seeing, or just happened to have happened recently, is on the diligence side, we got a request to do an IT diligence. So, for as a reminder, I lead the digital technology practice, and we do IT diligence as part of our day-to-day jobs. And one of the things that we got asked is, how easy would it be for this company to have access to data to be able to report and understand the tariffs? And so that was kind of almost like a double click on the diligence, where we went a little deeper than we'd gone before and kind of got some questions we hadn't really heard before. And so as you're working through some of these things and putting together that model and understanding what that holdback would be, or what was the word again for it? Sorry, you said it.
Holdback.
Holdback. Yep. Oh, good. Okay. It. What that holdback would be. Is that something you would do through a diligence work stream? Would you try to do that internally? Kind of how do I figure that component out, or how do I figure out what that estimate might be if I'm the buying entity?
Yeah, I mean, I would say that in most cases, it's going to come in two phases, the first of which would be during what's called preliminary due diligence. The second phase would be during what's called confirmatory due diligence, right? So preliminary diligence is typically, you understand that a business is going to come up for sale, you learn about it briefly, you say, hey, that's really interesting to me, but I got to learn a lot more about it before I decide, like, I'm really interested, right? So you're going to do some maybe market research, and some of this could be desk research, right? You maybe spend a little time understanding the company. You go to their website. You're talking with the investment banker who's helping to sell the company. You're asking them questions. Maybe you get a phone call with management. Unlikely these days, but sometimes you'll get a meeting with management. It depends on, you know, how big the deal is and how the process is being run. you're just trying to kind of digest and absorb and understand things. And typically during that phase, the investors are going to put together a brief financial model that says, hey, if we paid this much for the business and the business grew like X and Y and Z over a period of time, we think it would be a good investment. It would meet our investment thresholds. Something like tariffs, which have been now on everybody's radar for, call it 4 to 6 months, investors are thinking through that as they're building the model, right? So they're going to be building in some hedges. You know, what if tariffs go to 40%? What if they only go to 10%? What if it only goes for Mexico? What if it goes to Canada exclusively, just as examples? So there's going to be some of that priced in the preliminary diligence. They're going to make an offer to acquire the business. They should be communicating that up front because it's kind of a known thing that these tariffs could be coming. So they may communicate that up front when they put in their initial offer, say, hey, I'll pay you $100 million for the business, but by the way, it's going to be subject to this thing. In many cases, it's going to say, almost every one of those offers is going to say subject to confirmatory diligence, right? And if the business that's putting itself up for sale agrees that they want to sell the business to that investor under those terms, when the investor comes in to then do the next phase of confirmatory due diligence, that's when people are going to go typically like 10 miles deep on these issues, right? So that's when they're hiring the folks to do IT diligence, operations diligence, tariff diligence, supply chain diligence, quality of earnings due diligence. And that's really where all the details going to get flushed out. And then as they march towards signing the purchase agreement, that's where they're going to work with the lawyers to kind of fine tune, hey, if it is $20 million going into this escrow account, if it is specifically for tariffs, here's going to be the terms that it gets released upon. Here's going to be the terms that it gets returned back to the investors. And that'll all get hammered out then. And then, you know, the deal closes and everybody's off and running and hopefully it works out for all parties. You know, I think a common misconception about M&A, you hear a lot of people talk, and they're not wrong, that investors want to make sure they get the right price, a good price for the business. Most businesses don't get sold for cheap. Most businesses get sold for around about how much they're pretty much worth, because many investors tend to value businesses in a similar way. And the investor groups are actually, quite frankly, they're happy to pay for, they're happy to have those things like an escrow release, because that means that the business, back to my COVID example, it did bounce back to $10 million in earnings and they bought a good business for the right price. But likewise, if the earnings don't come back or if the tariff impact is higher, they don't want to be the one sitting there kind of holding the entirety of the bag going, oh, geez, we way overpaid for this business, right? They want it to be kind of a mutually equitable deal so that you know, at least from a starting point perspective, the seller walks away with a good amount of consideration and the buyers bought what they thought that they were buying. That really is the intent. And that's typically how most folks are approaching it.
I mean, that clarity is, I think, something that I haven't seen or read about yet. So I appreciate you having that insight. I feel like I've asked you a lot of questions. You got any questions for me on my tariff journey?
Well, I'll turn the tables on you. How are you seeing the operating companies hedge against tariff risks?
So a lot of conversations, right? Like we have a lot of conversations and I think folks are looking for sources aren't Wall Street Journal and others. And I get asked the question a lot of like, what are the other clients doing about tariffs? And what are you thinking about this? And what's new? And so I think there's some interesting dynamics there. Going back to diligence, we're seeing even on kind of our confirmatory diligence as we were doing buy-side diligence work, we're seeing organizations that have, like, for example, we were looking at a bakery in Canada that exclusively sold to the U.S. So, like, really technical baking stuff that I don't understand that they were working on and they were selling to the U.S. And so I went on the rep and warranty call to represent the cybersecurity portion of the call. And on a 3-hour phone call, the first hour and 20 minutes was spent solely speaking about tariffs and what they're planning to do. And it kind of piled on from other groups in a way I've never heard a rep and warranty call go, because they're usually pretty structured. We all get the call sheet, you know your questions, you tick through, and you know everyone high fives and you get follow-up emails for additional detail. This one was a very interesting process. I think a lot of the times where I get to have a lot of visibility around tariffs, again, not an expert, just kind of we're all learning together, but see a lot of this, is we have a sourcing team at the company that a lot of times they call us to help with the system changes so the sourcing team can be more successful. So the perspective I'm going to take is the last 3 opportunities that came through that companies reached out to us and said, we need help on our systems for blank, and we'll reverse engineer that to say what folks are working on. So number one I had here was they were looking to diversify their sourcing. So a lot of times in the systems for ERPs, they don't have a lot of rich data around where that is coming from. They have the company, but they don't have where it's actually coming in from. And we know that a lot of manufacturing organizations could have multiple manufacturing facilities across the world. And so those raw materials or even some finished goods should be tagged with country of origin so you can quickly do that analysis. But we found pretty quickly in this engagement it wasn't. And so we worked with the team to update the ERP to bring that into the process. And then frankly, we added an additional layer of approval to say, hey, before you go source from a country that's a tariff risk country, so we call the field, I want to be able to run that through the senior leadership team to have a second double click on that or an approval process before we move forward. Where previously it was best price wins, great service, we know you. Now there's an additional layer and a bit of a consideration. Another one is, it's interesting how uncommon it is, but a CMS or a contract management system. This system allows you to have a centralized repository of all your contracts with vendors. And as you know, we all sign contracts all the time based on our delegation of authority. That is usually what people use to route. But at the end of the day, you probably informally load contracts in a folder on Windows, or you might have it in a shared folder on SharePoint. It's somewhere, but not really organized in a CMS. And that CMS allows you to see a central place for your pricing and your agreements and know where all that is. The beauty of that is you can know when a contract's coming up and try to negotiate preemptively a longer-term contract to, quote, lock in some pricing to at least hedge a bit while you figure out what the uncertainty is. So one of the things that we've seen is folks are looking for that visibility, a way to gather their contracts to be able to go to the field and negotiate. And then the third one, and we hear about this all the time, but we actually see a bit of this, is the reshoring and nearshoring of a lot of the services and not using the companies outside. So for example, the big news, Mike, you and I are big Apple users and we love our Apple devices. And I live in Houston. And so I'd say every friend I have sent me the same dang news article that was like, Houston's one of the cities selected to have Apple do some reshoring, right? So we kind of hear these big things in the news all the time on large organizations, but smaller organizations every day, all day, our teams, you know, Mike and I, we both know people that sit in the northern side of Mexico all the time on that nearshoring group that's bringing some of those businesses that were in Asia or Southeast Asia back to Mexico. What's interesting now is as we're having conversations about footprint analysis, and we have a footprint team to help folks move organizations or distribution centers or manufacturing facilities, we're actually hearing a lot about looking for spaces and places in the United States. So we often hear, hey, there's a lot of extra space, offices are opening up, buildings are empty, those type of things. But now it's interesting, the pendulum has swung that people are trying to find prime locations near interstates, centrally located in the country with affordable resources, i.e. employees in that region, to start to nearshore. And so from a systems perspective, when you take things that were manufactured offshore, we didn't have to have an MRP or manufacturing systems because you outsourced that. Now you're bringing that in-house. Not only do you have to find a facility, find humans, you also have to stand up all the systems to support that. And so those are the big three things that we're seeing that folks are asking for help from a system perspective. Is there one that you think maybe I missed on what you're seeing out there?
No, I mean, I think, like I said earlier, we're still early days on seeing how people respond to this, right? And I think no right answer for all businesses. I think it's going to be a combination of everything you touched on, diversifying the sourcing, better contract management, better visibility, more reshoring, probably more nearshoring, even though some of the nearshore options are going to come with tariffs. I think you're just going to see a lot of companies rethink these global supply chains in an attempt to drive less cost volatility, more long-term stability. And ultimately, whether these businesses are publicly owned or privately owned, you know, if they're public, it's going to be, how do we figure out how to keep the street happy in the midst of all this turbulence? And on the privately owned side, you know, how do we drive sustainable earnings growth, right, in the wake of these headwinds? So it's going to be an interesting next couple of years, and we'll just have to see how everybody goes.
So can I ask you the trivia question this week?
Go for it.
All right, man. I was shocked at this answer, so I didn't know this. I had to look it up. But which country is the largest trading partner of the U.S. today?
So I actually do know the answer.
Ooh.
Because when the tariff thing heated up again, I was curious. And I think there was an article about it. And I thought for sure it was China, but it turns out it's our friends to the north, the Canadians.
Very good. By the way, that is one of, I don't know how many episodes, 13 that we've gotten correct. I gotta do a little bit of research. But yeah. I think it's interesting because I think you hear a lot of noise about everywhere else being a large trade partner, but it really shows how interconnected we are because it is someone in our own backyard.
Yeah.
Good job.
It kind of makes sense. I think for me, I always struggle with how could that small of a population represent our largest trading partner?
Right.
But yeah, our friends to the north.
Good job.
Somehow in those long winters up there, they're keeping it going. Good for
them. Hey, good for you for getting it right. You are on the leaderboard up 1-0. 1-13, I think, as per another episode we talked about.
There you go. Accurate. Great. Well, good one. Good one, James. Love the trivia. Well, thanks for everybody for tuning in to another episode of Growing EBITDA. Don't forget to like and subscribe, and we will chat with you guys again soon.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of Growing EBITDA. If you like this episode, hit subscribe or follow us on LinkedIn for updates. Got a topic you'd like us to cover? Drop us a message. We'd love to hear from you.